This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Matthew Pegas. Matt and I just got back from watching Jay Dyer at the Mercado Sagrado event at Paramount Ranch in Malibu. And we have a video up of the speech up on YouTube. Matt, great having you on.
Great to be on as always, Robert. Looking forward to talking about Jay Dyer and the speech we saw.
Jay Dyer has been a guest on The Stark Truth. Yeah, I think it's been twice. So one show focused on esoteric Hollywood and themes in film. And the other show we did, I think that specialized on Twin Peaks and Lynch?
Yeah, Lynch and I think Twin Peaks in particular.
So Jay Dyer has a lot of similar interest in us and how politics relate to culture and film in particular and symbolism. I guess it'd be interesting to kind of contrast like our background with his and like kind of where we overlap and maybe where there's like a different outlook.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of parallels. There's a lot of similar interest in politics, and I think there's similar interest in the intersection of politics and culture, as well as some similar aesthetics. If you look at his stuff versus your stuff and our stuff, there's a similar kind of vaporwave aesthetic. Where we differ, and we also, I think, are making a lot of the same criticisms of power structures. He's kind of also critical of both big government and big corporations in the way that we are. So there's parallels there too. I do think that our kind of criticism is grounded in something slightly different than his. He is more into kind of conspiracy and espionage, whereas I think our criticism leans more towards the... And his criticism is very philosophical as well, but ours is more solely that without necessarily getting into conspiracy per se.
And also, your background is slightly different than mine. You kind of came to a lot of this via my show.
Yes.
And I was kind of connected to that scene, I guess, around, like, the scene that kind of revolved around the Ron Paul movement that predated the alt-right. And things conspiracy theories were a major theme in that subculture.
Yeah, so you were more involved in that actually kind of earlier in your career, as I understand it. It's also worth throwing out there, speaking of backgrounds and such, that another thing that I personally have in common with Jay Dyer is that I, too, studied philosophy and literature at university. And I guess Jay actually was in a PhD program for some time, and I think maybe he's in a master's program. I don't remember whether or not he completed it, but eventually found himself disillusioned. Based on the kind of leftist groupthink of the campus climate. And I never enrolled in a graduate program, but I do have that same background and kind of came, to some degree, to the same conclusion that it's not really a welcome place for people with kind of right-of-center views on anything.
And is it kind of interesting, like, the contrast at the event between Dyer's connections to... I won't use the word alt-right because that has a connotation, but I think it's safe to say dissident right because that implies like a broader tent. But connections to the dissident right, to the kind of the culture there, which I would describe as either like Bobo or basically like rich hippies.
Yeah, definitely quintessential Bobo, and not even Yeah, I mean, both of the Beaux, both bohemian and bourgeois, because with general hippie culture, like at Woodstock, for example, back in 1969, if you went there, there probably would be some kind of rich kids, but also a more lower middle class element. But this Mercado Sagrado Fair was very much upper middle class hippies.
Yeah, it was almost comical to see like someone dressed in full on hippie garb, like stepping out of like a brand new Range Rover.
Yeah, I'm sure it's intensified by the fact that we're in the Los Angeles and Malibu area as well. Because I mean, I'm sure there's other parts of the country like New York State where I've spent a lot of time where there still would be a more authentic kind of lower middle class element, but very bourgeois. But anyway, I think the question you were asking is about the interesting parallels and also just contrast between Jay and the event more largely. And I mean, he's definitely someone, I don't think he considers himself alt-right per se, but he memes like the dissident right, and he associates with people on it. And I think his position is a little different because he's coming from the conspiracy angle, and he's a little bit more moderate on a lot of things, the same way we are. But still, a lot of the views are kind of in line. But there still is, I think this is what we're getting into talking about, there still is an element that he also probably, it's not a completely unnatural fit, because there are, and we saw this, there are a lot of people in places like a hippie fair who are going to be more open-minded, and who are, you know, maybe they're probably, some of them are going to be on the, a lot of them are going to be on the dissident left. And which is a place where you can find more the same kind of criticisms of power structures that be that you're going to find on the dissident right. So this is an interesting horseshoe theory angle.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, I noticed that whole theme with the horseshoe theory. I mean, there is a lot of overlap between the dissident right and dissident left. I mean, that's obviously a major theme to like the concept of the alt center. But just kind of my observations of the event itself. So the majority of the people in the audience were Jay Dyer's fans, but there was definitely a segment who were other people who were more from the kind of general audience who were coming over and open-minded.
Yeah, I mean, what we had was, as Jay kind of points out, I think it made it into the video, was a very intimate setting. There was probably about 20 people under the pavilion listening, which was cool in a lot of ways. Several of them, quite a few of them, maybe about half of them, including us, were people who had come to the event only for Jay Dyer. And I mean, there were people, I don't think I heard about anyone from out of state, but there were definitely people who came from like the Bay Area, so some real followers there. But then there was also another contingent of people who seemed to be just people who had kind of straggled over, and they had some interesting questions to ask. None of them were rude or anything like that. And there's a couple people who I couldn't figure... Well, this one guy in particular who I couldn't figure out because he was bare feet, had a big beard, like he really looked the hippie.
Oh,
part.
The guy who said he knew people at Charlottesville.
Yeah,
but it wasn't clear which side they were.
He looked the part. I actually thought I saw him at one. He may have even been a vendor, but he basically... I don't think he was there just for Jay, and he didn't stick around after much, but he was definitely on board with a lot of what he was saying in terms of talking about conspiracy and whatnot. And yeah, he did, as you said, he did say he knew some people at Charlottesville, though he did not say on which side, so that was intriguing.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. With the kind of the overlap between the dissident right and the dissident left, they have different solutions and different critiques, but they're both critiquing this kind of a oligarchic power structure. And I mean, even with us, I guess since we're alt-centrist, so we're probably closer to Jay politically than we are to, like, the rest of the people at the event. But we are kind of in a Venn diagram, maybe, like, where those two groups overlap, but just slightly closer to Jay.
I would definitely say that's accurate. I mean, some of what it is we're all very critical of corporations, and in many ways more critical of corporations than we are of big government, because we recognize that as a larger problem. And with regard to that, we're definitely in line with the dissident left. There's another element to this too, though, which we talk about in the Jay Dyer interview, also with regards to some of the art he was talking about, which is has to do with kind of creating sort of meta-dialectical spaces, was the word that we were using, in which you kind of take a step back from, I mean, and I'm not as much of a conspiracy theorist as Jay, but you take a step back from what many would perceive as a sort of created created conflict between, you know, differing views that are actually coming from the same fundamental source. When you take a step back away from that, so it's not about Republican or Democrat anymore, and you're able to look at some of these questions kind of objectively and try to get to the heart of the matter, then ideology itself doesn't even matter so much. You're looking at things in a kind of more pure way, and I think there was that element to the talk and to the...
With the whole theme of critiquing the power structure, kind of this goes into themes of conspiracy theories and deciphering the realities of power. So this gets a little bit complex, so... I mean, there definitely are leftist conspiracy theorists, but I'd say disproportionately it's revolved more around the dissident right, and that movement I was talking about that existed kind of prior to the alt-right. I mean, there is an element of the alt-right that's into conspiracy theories, but I'd say overall the alt-right is less so than the movement that existed prior to that, so that, I guess you would call it maybe the Patriot Movement. And then there's this kind of, generally the view that conspiracy theories are just an analogy for just the overall critique of kind of a corporate power structures, and that type of view overlaps, that's more common on the left, and that overlaps definitely the dissident right, so... Mm-hmm. Conspiracy theories are an attempt to understand these power structures, and then from there you have to go and decipher what is real and what is not. And then there's a theme of like what is right in front of you, and there's so many social societal problems that we can see right in front of us. And then there's the issues of like understanding the mechanisms of power. And that's what leads people to looking into things that are more secretive, and that gets to the themes of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, what I always say about conspiracy theories is that, with some exceptions, like I have no idea what Flat Earth is all about. But what I always say about them is that they, again, with a few exceptions, they always correspond to something. Even if nothing else, they correspond to a lack of trust in the kind of social order, which is itself a problem that they can call attention to. But a lot of them also just contain, or I would say almost all of them that are propagated by intelligent people anyway, contain a grain of truth. So like take for example the conspiracy theory that there's like Pizzagate, or even predating that, because I know that's a specific thing, like that there's like a ring of like pedophile Satanists in Hollywood or whatever. I certainly don't believe that there's like an organized gang that does that, but I do believe that there's a lot and have for a long time been a lot of people within the elite who do engage in those behaviors and do have connections to one another and do, you know, help each other in their abuse. I think there's a definite grain of truth there.
What happens is people pick up on real phenomenons and issues relating to the power structure. And obviously I want to add a disclaimer. I'm not saying anything that Jay Dyer is doing this. I'm just talking in a kind of a general sense. So people don't understand the mechanisms of power, so they're searching for answers. And then rumors spread. And with the whole theme of paranoia is people in the establishment will say that conspiracy theorists are mentally ill and they're paranoid, and there used to be the meme. It's an old meme of like the tinfoil hat. But if you analyze psychology, I mean, one of the key roots of paranoia is a feeling of powerlessness and not being in control of your destiny. And I mean, that's a psychological problem. People who are disconnected and lacking power in their personal life, that can lead to a mental instability and paranoia. I think the same relates to politics. If you're kind of left out of the power structure and you don't understand it, then you're going to take a more paranoid outlook. So it is relevant. Yeah, it is relevant to psychology. But the establishment will just say those people are mentally ill.
But that's what they'll say, that they're crazy. But I always say that just because someone may have some elements to them that are crazy doesn't mean that they're that their views aren't worth taking seriously on some level, or at least that they're not worth unpacking to some degree and seeing what is the truth in this, and also that the fact that there are people who may have these crazy views, that in and of itself, again, like I said, is a point of interest, because you wonder how we as a society got to that point where such a thing would be widespread.
Jay Dyer did talk about Edward Bernays, and Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Interesting to sort of analyze his motives as well as his impact.
I think he was more trying to use media to subject the masses to the will of the elite, and therefore create the best possible society. So he did have a kind of utopian vision, but I don't think he was trying to enlighten the masses per se. I think he would probably subscribe to a more elitist, right-wing view, maybe with the first precedent of this in Plato's The Republic, where he talks about, where Socrates discusses propagating a noble lie to the masses about how people of different social classes are created from different metals in order to keep them in their place. I think Bernays kind of comes more from that perspective, where he would propagate, not enlightening the masses, but pacifying them with the propagation of a certain view that maintains social order.
So yeah, I mean, there's definitely irony to that, because the whole philosophy of the Enlightenment, enlightened means to expose people to the truth. So enlightenment was all about, the Enlightenment was about truth seeking, and that the masses should be exposed to the truth. And in a sense, ironically, he was kind of a right wing or pre-Enlightenment, because,
or reactionary.
Because the belief is that the common man does not lack the intellect to understand the truth. So there needs to be this kind of higher elite who sets the agenda. And that's a very reactionary, traditionalist way of thinking, which is...
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's inherently traditionalist, but definitely a lot of traditionalists adhere to it. And it's also worth pointing out here that what Bernays was said particularly, he's considered one of the premier propagandists and the premier theorist of propaganda. He was an ad man. One of the things he's most famous for is marketing cigarettes to women, I think Marlboro cigarettes, and making them seem more feminine. So that's kind of the perspective he was coming from as an ad man. But he also had these very deep political views about the nature of the masses as an irrational herd that need to be guided by a propagandizing elite. But whether or not he's a traditionalist, I don't think he's a traditionalist at all. So I think that's probably what we should discuss.
Yeah, I mean, not traditionalist in the sense of a traditionalist society, but an anti-egalitarian view, a very elitist hierarchical view in that sense. So so going back to Freud, we did discuss Freud on our show we did about sexuality and Freudian analysis. So a lot of dissident right types, they dismiss basically everything Freud said. So as far as Freud's psychology, I believe that his a lot of his psychological theories are valid, but the question is what are his motives? A lot of people just debunk Freudian analysis completely as psychology. I actually respect the value in Freud's psychological idea, but I also think they can be used for they could be used for nefarious ends, or ends that at least conflict with what is the best interest for another group.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of people on like the dissident right would totally dismiss Freud as well as Bernays for anti-Semitic reasons. Basically, I take a much more nuanced approach where. There's some kind of documentary called The Century of Self that I have not actually seen, but that ties kind of Freudian thinking in with individualism, I suppose, and a generate, you know, like the a whole century, the 20th century, as kind of moving towards atomization and individualism. So there's a lot of people who really tie in psychoanalysis with that kind of degeneration of the culture. And I can see where they're coming from. However, I also think that it needs to be pointed out that in both the case of Freud with his views on psychoanalysis and the unconscious, and Bernays with his views on propaganda and the irrationality of the herd, etc., that they were right on a lot of levels. At least in my opinion, I believe that they were right, and that a lot of their insights are things that we need to reckon with and understand, even if we don't like the way that a lot of their work has kind of been used and the kind of society that we've been left with based on, you know, being controlled, or the elites being people who understand this kind of thing, doesn't make it any less true what they're saying. I mean, the old thing is like, there was some article that I saw recently titled "Hating Postmodernism Doesn't Make the Times Any Less Postmodern," and I think there's a lot of truth to that. I basically think both Bernays and Freud were great thinkers, and I don't know if I'd love all the effects that maybe their work has had, but I don't know. I take this attitude towards a lot of artists and intellectuals. I don't look at the supposed impact of their work. I kind of view them more as people who are reflecting just kind of what they see.
Another group that Dyer has talked about in his book Esoterica Hollywood, I think, yeah, he touched on them with Huxley as the Fabian socialist, and Huxley wrote Brave New World. So I actually don't know that much about the entire political agenda of the Fabian socialists, but they were a major group in power in the UK. So the UK is one of the most poorly run countries, so if their policies were implemented in the UK, just the fact that the situation, the way the UK is proof that they're obviously not such a great group. But as mm-hmm. As far as Huxley goes, some people view him as like a whistleblower, a warning of this agenda of the elites. Then there's Dyer's view. Dyer actually sees him more as a nefarious figure.
I think the vast majority of people who like Huxley and who've read Huxley have a positive view of Huxley, and they see him as a bringer of truth, as a very kind of red-pilled individual, whether you see that, you know, just as someone who kind of sees things for how they are. That's definitely the perception of Aldous Huxley. I think Dyer's the only person I've ever met who thought he was somehow... Well, Dyer's one of the only conspiracy theorists I've ever met, so maybe that's why. He's one of the few people I've met who actually thinks he was working with, you know, a governmental agency.
If you are covering up a conspiracy, you would generally want to be as secretive as possible, but occasionally you get these types who want to, I suppose hypothetically, someone would want to give out clues, or you get people who get boastful, but for the most part, if there was some kind of a conspiracy... But a lot of these political movements in American history that have been disruptive, a lot of their ideas have actually been documented out in the open. I mean, whether it's the Frankfurt School or neoconservatism, I mean, those have been disruptive political movements, but they're not necessarily vast secretive conspiracies. Most of their work is well documented and open for examination.
Yeah, and I guess Dyer's point and the point of thinkers like him would be that while the work may be out in the open, it was being funded privately or perhaps not so privately and encouraged by powers that be that sought to benefit from the societal impacts it would have. Now, it's interesting. The relationship with... I don't necessarily want to get super into this, but the relationship between... kind of Dyer's view and that of those who would cite Culture of Critique. There's a lot of parallels in some of the criticisms they make. Dyer seems to Dyer is more focused on it's kind of like Americanism and like the CIA and those in power who would propagate that, whereas Culture of Critique readers, well, we all know who they blame for everything. But both fundamentally see these broad cultural trends as being implemented by a specific subset who, whether through money power, mostly through money power, or even, you know, murder in some cases or conspiracy, propagate certain cultural trends which benefit their group and interests.
Then we have to get to the question is, how do you create an elite, an ideal elite for a society? And Dyer's general view is that the elites should emerge from the middle class as a meritocracy, from a meritocracy.
Yeah, and that was in contrast. That was when we asked him about Bernays, because that's the thing I wanted to say about Edward Bernays, is that I basically totally 100% agree with his kind of analysis of society, of the masses as being irrational, and of their needing to be a kind of propagandizing elite. I mean, when I wrote that article titled Neon Nationalism or whatever, that's kind of part of what I was trying to get at, is that there needs to be a kind of cultural nationalism propagated through, well, culture. So that's basically Bernays' view. However, where Dyer would push back on Bernays, and where to a large extent I would as well, is that there's the question of, you know, where that elite comes from. And Bernays was tied up in a lot of stuff, probably most notably capitalism. He was an ad man. He basically helped a lot of corporations, as well as politicians, if you Google him, you can find a list of all the different politicians and corporations he worked for. He helped them garner their power. But I, as we've discussed, I don't see that as the ideal elite. So even if I may agree with Bernays' basic structural view, I still think society should be run in such a way that a completely different set of people is on top. And this was something that Dyer also pointed out, and he had a more... He's a traditionalist, and he would argue that it should, you know, a kind of meritocracy that which selects from the... You know, the middle class, basically the majority population of a country, because obviously the problem you have with global capitalism is that it selects for you know, these cosmopolitan types, these internationalist elites.
Yeah, so there is this trend towards economic oligarchy, but it's a lot more complex than that, because I know a lot of conspiracy theorists, they have this idea that it's just like all these old wealth families running everything, like the British royal family, the Rothschilds. But
the
reality,
the
Freemasons, Masons, of course, and they focus on these really old wealth families that go back like centuries in some cases, or even like the 19th century robber barons. But the reality is a lot of the economic elites in power, they're people from maybe like middle to upper middle class backgrounds. They have the right combination of traits that are able to thrive within the current system. So just this whole kind of dichotomy between kind of a shadow elite versus a middle class meritocracy, it doesn't address these core issues. Like, what traits do you want to reward in a society? Because you could have someone who comes from a middle-class background and still becomes part of a corrupt elite. So a lot of these people are people who are from fairly middle-class backgrounds, but they have the right skills that are able to thrive in our current society. So I think just having a meritocracy that enables middle-class people to rise up is not enough. You want to have a culture and a system that rewards the best traits, so that you need to kind of go further than that.
I would certainly agree with that. I really just want to cite this meme because it's been so hot this week. I think it's kind of fluctuates who is selected for, but right now I would say it's the kind of non-playable character cast of people who, at least in the media, kind of get selected for. So people who are willing to just kind of parrot the prevailing hip opinions. I just wanted to bring that up because it's that meme is pretty much the biggest meme since Pepe. And very funny. But yeah, no, to answer your question, definitely thinking about what traits you would want to select for an elite. Once you take the basic Bernays premise, that basic, well, it's not just Bernays who's argued for this, obviously, it's also, you know, probably Nietzsche had a similar view, that basic premise of elitism, of, you know, the masses as inherently irrational and in need of being led by a cast of culture creators and, you know, intellectuals or whatever, which is my view and which is Bernays' view. Once you accept that, then it's just a question of what traits do you select for in that elite? And, well, as we've talked about in the past, for me, and I think for you as well, the you know, the people who I think should have the, you know, highest role in society are the basically the artists and the intellectuals, the philosopher kings, if you will.
You got this concept of natural aristocracy, and we've talked about that in regards to Aleister Crowley. And there was that essay Keith Preston wrote about Crowley, about his ideas. Crowley talked a lot about a natural elite that is not able to thrive in a system where you have an economic elite that, or a political elite that bases their power off the masses of consumers, or just like or manipulating voters. A kind of natural aristocracy of the best people rather than the people who can appeal to the largest numbers of people, like the people who are the most elite rather than the most popular. So, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to Crowley's views. As far as Dyer goes, I am actually fascinated. I'm fascinated with Dyer's work because he's able to make all these Crowleyan references to these different films, but he tends to view Crowley as a much more nefarious figure for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I did bring up in the Q&A is that there is this irony that both a lot of figures within the cultural elite and a lot of political dissidents, basically they admire Crowley, or at the very least are fascinated by him. And I think part of it is because he wanted to transform society and basically to rebel against tradition and basically to reinvent society. So that theme is relevant. So originally there was elements of the new elite that were coming to power in the 20th century, and they resented the older, more traditional elites and aristocracies, and some of them maybe saw something about Crowley that appealed to them, and they latched onto Crowley. But now you have all these people who are, I mean, counterculture figures, anti-establishment, political dissidents, and they're basically discovering Crowley's ideas, and they're mm-hmm. very fascinated in Crowley for similar reasons, but they're rebelling against something totally different. So there are these parallel ironies. And, I mean, Dyer obviously is not a fan of Crowley, but he does acknowledge that dichotomy. And then for the 60s counterculture icon, I think it was more that they saw him as this guy who was just a libertine, and he was screwing on pyramids and doing drugs. So there's kind of that angle. Which, I mean, that's a little bit superficial, and that doesn't, that kind of ignores his philosophical ideas.
It does. I mean, I think for the people in the 60s, what Crowley represented was kind of throwing off the shackles of tradition towards, you know, garnering pleasure. But as I think we're learning more and more, that's not an inherently left-wing idea at all. Because I think what Crowley taps into, at risk of sounding too much like a Crowleyite, because I definitely wouldn't, you know, fully describe myself that way, but there's a perennialism to his views. In many ways, he is classified as a traditionalist, I think, because what a lot of his work kind of focuses on is this, you know, is power dynamics and these kind of eternal truths about power dynamics and power, the struggle for power, whether sexually or politically. So that, of course, that's going to be of interest to anyone in power, because they're the dominant ones. But it's also going to be interesting to anyone who lacks power, because they're the ones who want to gain power. So I think power is kind of a central concept here. Crowley had a lot of insightful and just brutally truthful things to say about power. The same could be said of Nietzsche. And that is interesting and of fascination to anyone who's in power, especially people who are kind of more secretive in the power they have, because obviously a lot of Crowley is taboo. But it's also going to be interesting to those who would want to rebel and create a new order. So he kind of taps into that, again, what we're describing earlier as kind of meta-dialectical space, where it's not about us versus them, but rather about the nature of us versus them in the first place.
With my novel, Journey to Vapor Island, I was actually working on that while I recorded those shows of Dyer, so there definitely are some influences from Dyer's work in that novel. I would actually be curious to see, to get a Dyer's review of the book and how he would pick up on a lot of the themes. But I kind of view the Roger Blackstone character as like a counter-Illuminati, in a sense. So, in conspiracy theory circles, there's this idea of the Illuminati. And you could say there's an angle to Blackstone that is populist, in the sense that he wants to benefit the masses. But Blackstone's ideas are more... There's the themes of aristocratic radicalism, but there's also an angle to Blackstone that is very secretive. And he is kind of this shadow figure, so...
Yeah, he's the type of person who someone like, if he actually existed, someone like Jay Dyer or any conspiracy theorist would probably think was totally Illuminati-affiliated and Freemason-affiliated. But there's a real sense also that he's kind of counter to the powers that be. And I think, as you've noted, Trump is kind of, would be a kind of real-world analogy. Or at one point there was a hope that he would be.
Yeah, maybe not. Now it just seems like he's a generic Republican, but during the elections in 2016, that's what people were saying about Trump. He was just kind of a counter-elite. So that's funny you mentioned that. In my book, one of the character, the Justin Green character, the libertarian, in the debate, Justin Green says that Blackstone is an Illuminati cultist, New World Order shill, whose father hanged out with Crowley. I do think that if there really was a Roger Blackstone today, there would be a lot of conspiracy types would be suspicious of him. I do plan on releasing a future book that will reveal more about the Blackstone character. In the first book, I keep him. He's a pretty this mysterious shadow figure.
Yeah, well, Justin Green's a libertarian, and libertarians tend to... a lot of conspiracy theorists lean libertarian in their views on human nature and the kind of right of everyone to full knowledge and, to manifest their own destiny. What's interesting about Dyer is that he's not a libertarian. He said this in his talk. He's much more of a traditionalist. He's basically quasi-alt-right in his views. But he still is also very critical of power structures. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's the whole issue with a lot of... That kind of annoys me about a libertarian conspiracy theorist is they just think that... that liberty and individualism is the solution, because we have these vast power structures. The reality is, if the only way to counter these power structures is to utilize the power of the state.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of libertarians think like this kind of salt of the earth character that the Republican Party has been and the Libertarian Party as well has been appealing to for decades is the ideal. And I think when really interesting aspect of the alternative right is that it kind of is a type of conservatism that gets rid of that notion and looks back towards a kind of more Nietzschean or Crowleyan ideal of an overman or of an elite that would be in power but would guide the masses in a positive and productive way.
And Dyer made an interesting comment about social atomization. So what's happening now is social isolation is creating these people who are disconnected, and they can be easily manipulated. And then basically what Dyer is saying will happen is then that will be a way for the power structure to easily consolidate their power, because there won't be cohesive groups to challenge them. So that, I mean, that absolutely is what is happening right now, but the key question is whether that is orchestrated. So yeah, he was going back with the kind of history of the Fabian Socialists and Brave New World. I'm more inclined to think that a social atomization is a product of cultural trends. So a lot of these trends have to do with demographic change, suburban sprawl, and dependence on the automobile. And
then technological changes.
Yeah, the kind of lifestyle of starting with the television, and now a lot of people spending most of their times indoors online. So I'm more inclined to take that view, but I am open-minded into hearing Dyer's view that a lot of these issues could be orchestrated. But I think it's just a product
of... I'm very open-minded, and I enjoyed his talk thoroughly, and I enjoy his work thoroughly. But I lean away a little, definitely more so than him, from the view that things are kind of planned out in advance. Now, he will cite kind of, you know, documents and books and things to support this. So I recognize he's a very smart guy. He's done his research. And he, in many ways, he knows more about it than myself. So I'm in no way disparaging his work. But just at base, I tend towards leaning away from thinking in conspiratorial terms. I lean away from thinking that everything is that orderly. I think things are a lot more chaotic, and that that definitely I think certain trends are supported by people in power who stand to benefit from them. But I just don't think, I tend to not think there's this overall plan. But on some level, it doesn't completely matter, because the criticisms we're making of these trends and of the powers that be are at core the same.
Well, he talked about the whole idea that that Asperger's syndrome or autism is being promoted. So I don't know if he went into the whole thing about vaccinations, but
I don't think he brought up vaccinations. No, I don't think
he did.
No.
He did say it's increasing. So his view is that they tend to make good drones for corporations and the elites. I interviewed that guy, Jason Horsley, from Audi Culture, and he would probably have a very different outlook, but I've also heard the view that the people with Asperger syndrome are like radical nonconformist, and they're obviously vastly overrepresented in dissident politics. Those actually seem like the kind of people you would, least from the standpoint of a conformist establishment, you would want less of those people. You want the people, kind of people you want are non-NPCs, non-playable characters, and people who are just going to go along, so...
Definitely, and autists, people with autism and Asperger's are not that. A few things that I'm having to say, because it's really interesting. Dyer, for as much as he believes things are planned, he never said things couldn't backfire. And I would think that and I don't believe this necessarily, if Asperger's was something that was purposely instituted, it really probably backfired from what it was intended to do. And if you know, the atomization of the internet is another thing I'll bring up, was intended to atomize, it's kind of backfiring as well, because in both cases, I tweeted something earlier, which is a little bit faster than I usually get, but I said that a lot of the alternative right is kind of a coalition of, or rather what I said specifically, because the alt-right's a pretty big tent, is that the vanguard of the kind of cultural nationalist uprising we're seeing is a coalition of autists, incels, psychopaths, and dissident queers, were the groups I gave. So there's a lot of...
I think people who are connected to a community and a church, I mean, that is much better for your overall well-being and mental health, but those types of people are not producing innovation in culture and politics. I mean, like, I don't think that, like, fundamentalist Mormons are just more traditional, like, people with more 1950s values. They're healthier. They have maybe healthier lifestyles, but they're not producing the most innovation. It's the people who are the most socially isolated, who are removed.
Yeah, who are basically
removed from the bounds of from society's social constructs. That those people who are removed from those, who are freed up from that, they're the ones who are the ones putting out ideas that are subversive, both politically and culturally. So social isolation, maybe the elites. So the elites are benefiting from that, but it could also backfire.
Yeah, definitely. In the case of Asperger's in particular, I think the idea is that that group would have been created to be especially good at certain kinds of jobs, but that group is also a very unhappy group a lot of the time, but when, you know, first given the social issues that they're likely to face, and therefore they apply that excellent attention span and mindset of you know, getting really obsessed with things and whatnot, they apply that to subversive ends, such as the alt-right. I actually just saw on Facebook today, it was part of the inspiration of that quote, like this, like, autistic 20-year-old whose mother had made him, like, a Pepe the Frog birthday cake or something. So, you know, just like, you know, my son has autism and Trump is the thing he's latched on. So, yeah, that energy can definitely become very subversive. It was quite funny. One thing I wanted to say, though, is the internet you kind of pointed to as something that can lead to atomization. But I also think it's really important to note that even if I might prefer, you know, the kind of a traditionalist community, with the internet, it's also creating alternative communities. I mean, that's what the alternative right is. So that would be backfiring, too.
People have the power to choose their own community. So it's a way to kind of, I mean, it's not traditionalism. It's like meta-modernity. You get to choose your own community because maybe social isolation is this temporary phase we have to go through. Because the problem with tradition is you were stuck in a community. So the traditional communities were cohesive. But when you get to choose your own community, that also gives you a lot of power, a lot more power that didn't exist in the past.
Yeah, new tribalism is forming, and I think the internet is largely responsible for it. Now, I personally don't like to spend all of my time on the computer. I like a kind of in real life community as well. So I'm not here saying that there's no problems with it. But what I am saying is that the internet has led us to be more atomized. But there's also a kind of digital communitarianism that's arising out of it. That, I mean, as long as there's still computers, as long as the internet is still working, that's the way of the future. There's no question.
Well, I mean, one thing about that conspiracy theorists say is that everything is planned out. This kind of elite utopianism. I actually think a lot of problems in society are just a product of a lack of vision. I mean, one example I'll just throw out there, because I talk a lot about architecture and urbanism on the show, is that there hasn't really been any cohesive or utopian visions in urban planning. That's one example. But I think that's just true of our politics. I think that a lot of things, a lot of politicians and businessmen, they're just thinking of, like, what is good in the short term? Like, what will get me elected? What will make me a short-term profit? So I think a problem, actually, is a lack of a utopian vision. So
definitely.
That's one thing I'm kind of...
And that's the flip side of a total lack of social cohesion, which is a product of postmodernity, of this, you know, mode of being that we've fallen into, of kind of radical relativism. But what we're entering into, not to sound totally pretentious and stupid, but we're entering into a new age now. We kind of hit postmodernity, and we're entering into, with the help of the internet, we're entering into postmodernity, in which we're kind of realizing that, yes, there's a, this also goes back to Freud and Bernays, I would say. Oh, intellectually, all of that stuff is true. You know, there's no, a lot of what would have been taken for objective in modernity is not objective at all. And there is this kind of radical subjectivism a balance. But we're also realizing that in order to be happy, we need to cling on to larger visions, larger senses of identity, and we're creating brand new ones on the internet. So I think that's kind of where we are in the West right now. And I mean, there's a lot of ways it could go wrong, but there's a lot of potential there too.
One thing Dyer touched on that is interesting is these concepts of smart cities. And I don't think I've talked about smart cities per se. I do talk about self-contained cities. Smart cities are these concepts. They're actually planning one in Toronto where the whole city is interconnected with technology. I mean, it would be a dystopian nightmare if Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos were in power. But the question is, if say it was like a social nationalist independent city state, would it inherently be a bad thing if you had like the right people in charge and you were in charge of things?
I definitely don't think it would be inherently a bad thing, no. Yeah, no, there's a lot of potential there. It's just a question of how that would come about when there's so much kind of internationalist, globalist interest in retaining power and quashing any independent sovereignty.
I don't think Dyer talked about UN Agenda 21. I know that is a big thing, so I think UN Agenda 21 was big with the kind of Tea Party and the kind of boomer patriot movement types. So basically, it was a UN plan. It was a non-binding resolution that would implement like smart growth or sustainable development. And a lot of people believe that any type of development or urbanism that is more mixed use or transit oriented, away from the single family model, is part of this UN conspiracy theory. Are you familiar with that theory?
No, I'm actually not familiar with it at all. So
that's kind of the move. That's the more traditional. That's the more kind of a reactionary right. I think what I'm seeing now, especially coming from millennials. I mean, especially what we're doing, which is different, but even with the more generic alt-right, is I think there is this kind of a sense of utopianism, as opposed to with kind of a right-wing movements in the past. It's always been more reactionary, like just kind of a just sort of the whole kind of,
or paleocon.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but preserving or well, there's nothing left to preserve in some important sense, I would say. So now all we have...
So you have someone thinking, like, they want to preserve just their, like, track house down in the suburbs. That's what they have, and that's what's precious to them. So that's what they want to hold on to, and they're not thinking in a utopian sense. But I do think... I mean, there's just so much interesting information in... well, I'm reading Jay Dyer's Esoterica Hollywood... But what I do find, so many ironies, is that there actually is a lot of overlap between this group that you would call the Illuminati and a lot of political dissidents. I think one example is just kind of the appeal of aesthetics. So, Dyer talks about a lot of these different films from the 80s, and... He talks about the occultist symbols in them, but obviously these are films he enjoyed. He grew up in the 80s, so these are films he enjoyed watching. And obviously, I mean, the aesthetics are very appealing. And one thing I find really ironic is that a lot of these occultist symbols the more traditional paleoconservative types, they were focused more on a kind of a Christian Americana view. So they were focused on maybe thinking about the American flag and more focused on America and Protestant Christianity per se.
Yeah, just kind of those austere Protestant aesthetics, which I pretty much abhor. Yeah.
Well, a lot of the current alt-right are interested in a lot of the ancient pagan symbols. And those were the people, those older paleoconservatives were the people who would talk a lot about occultist symbols, like kind of like the Egyptian pyramids. And with the Freemasons, the Freemasons were a group that emerged with the new mercantile elite that surpassed the old aristocracy and they were fascinated with a lot of ancient pre-Christian symbols, especially from Egypt. So there just are these kind of ironies of these different groups. So you have the old aristocracy, the new mercantile elite with the Masons, then the kind of American, middle-class American Protestant culture, and then this new dissident movement. So, I mean, yeah, it's the same irony with Peel of Crowley, how there is this interest in occultist symbolism. And I noticed that a lot of these symbols, like the pyramid, you see it a lot in vaporwave and retrowave, and even a lot of alt-right symbols, like Keck, that's like the perfect example.
Yeah, well, it's pagan and it's perennial. It's kind of old, you know, truths that are as old as the hills about power dynamics and politics and sex and art as expressions thereof of the will to power that are kind of rearing their coming back, shall we say, in postmodernity, there's this kind of deconstruction of everything. So it's like there is no truth. And once we've hit that point in society where we've thoroughly deconstructed ourselves, what we're going back to are the most primal truths. And those are the truths that are explored in paganism and by those symbols you mentioned. And there is a kind of meta-dialectical nature to it as well. So it's fascinating. And I would say vaporwave is a very sort of pagan genre in a lot of ways. A lot of the, like Witch House too, a lot of, and even Cloud Rap, a lot of genres that have emerged from the internet kind of have this pagan spirit, or also described as like a hauntological spirit, where it's like ghosts of the past, unfulfilled promises from the past kind of being re-explored in a kind of magical, magicalized kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, he also made an interesting point about new wave music and there's a theme of occultist symbolism, but I mean, it's interesting kind of these ironies. So I know when new wave music came out in the 80s, a lot of people who were of the 60s or 50s or 60s generation, they were saying it was synthetic because it was electronic. But now a lot of people are saying, and I certainly feel this way, that music, whether it's 80s new wave or even a lot of the more newer retro wave and vapor wave music, has a like otherworldly aura to it. It has an ethereal quality that is missing in today's music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I made a big thing in one of my first blog posts about New Order, which has a kind of interesting esoteric name for a band, as well as a lot of symbolism they use on their album covers. There's even just to the synthesizer as an instrument, there's an ethereal quality to it, and I don't know, it's kind of hard to parse exactly what it is, but it definitely... There's something perhaps archaeo-futuristic about it, where it's kind of presenting these visions of an idealized future, but also often hearkening back to the past in a way. And you see that with vaporwave, certainly, where it's futuristic imagery or retro-futuristic imagery, but also like ancient Roman busts and whatnot. But even like genres that predate vaporwave by a couple decades, like new wave, also dabbled in some of those aesthetics. Again, I'm thinking of New Order and some of their album covers and their general aesthetic.
And you see this the same in architecture. What did you think about that West Side Pavilion roof entrance we filmed for our doc with David Cole? Would you say that, I mean, there's definitely an occultist element to that, like not just the pyramid, but the theme of like entering another portal?
Yeah, I mean, some of that's probably projected by us, but I mean, there is that grandeur to mall aesthetics where it kind of, and to get a little bit into like Marxist theory and cultural criticism, that you do see that with malls where they're kind of the religious temples of the postmodern consumerist era, and they have that kind of grandeur, and they have those kinds of aesthetics just on, based on their size and what they cater to. I was actually just walking or driving by an abandoned mall in the valley yesterday, and I saw the outside of an old Macy's where it had all these pillars, and it looked like an abandoned Roman temple almost.
I mean, I don't think that the developer of that or the architect was thinking about something cultist. I think it has more to do with just the kind of a postmodern era in architecture where they were kind of playing off these with these like ancient symbols, or postmodernism where you borrow from symbols from the past. That's my take on it.
Yeah, so, actually, what you said just there really triggered something for me in a positive sense relating to today's conversation in a lot of ways, which is that I think one aspect of Dyer's view that I would differ on is he really emphasizes, and a lot of conspiracy theorists will do this, the kind of the consciousness of every step of every planned thing that comes down to us from the elite.
Yeah,
this
because
view that it's
I
all
think
consciously ordained.
That
whereas my view is more Freudian, in that I think things are by and large totally unconscious. So I think it's very few people would like make a ball thinking about like, oh, I want to make this into a religious temple. I think it's all totally unconscious and tapping into these aspects of the unconscious mind that have been with us for as long as we've existed as human beings. And that's where some of this perennial stuff and this kind of pagan imagery comes from as well. It's all there in the unconscious, and it just gets carried out again and again, the same power structures.
And also the culture and hence the political system becomes its own living organism.
Definitely.
I mean, one thing that, Dyer does talk a lot about surrealism in his book, Esoteric Hollywood. I mean, yeah, surrealism relates a lot to film, especially Lynch. I mean, it relates to music, it could relate to architecture. So it's about creating this otherworldly aura, kind of the world of like the dream state. So,
yeah, the idea is of surrealism is to tap into the unconscious and kind of plumb its depths and kind of record in some way what you find there. That's definitely an ethos of David Lynch's work, and it's a lot of the type of work that Dyer explores.
So I asked him about occultist buildings in L.A. So he mentioned the Library Tower in downtown L.A., which that building was designed in the 80s, but it definitely has a Art Deco influence on the Crown. And there's that building. He mentions actually the Griffith Park Observatory. Have you been there?
Yes, very Masonic.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in looking at things from an architectural aesthetic level than a political level. So, yeah, I mean, there is that Masonic element to it. But there's another way to look at it. I mean, there's also an element of archaeo-futurism, like the theme of being technologically advanced for its time, but it also has a feeling of a kind of an ancient fortress you would see in like a fantasy film as you were like going across like the mountains or desert.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I think in a lot of retrofuturism, a lot of futurism and sci-fi imagery has always, I think, been influenced by, there's always been that archaic futuristic element. And I think
and
it's
one,
because we
yeah,
under,
I mean, one yeah. thing that we were talking a lot about, the architect John C. Portman and his Hyatt in San Francisco. I actually just found out that Portman was influenced by a 1930s science fiction film by H.G. Wells. So, yeah, it is interesting. The role that science fiction plays to architecture, and I know Brandon Adamson says his ideal utopia would be the film Logan's Run, and that's something that Dyer talks a lot about. So, what is interesting about film is so many of these grand aesthetic visions are portrayed in film, but they never get implemented into reality. I mean, that kind of ties in with the whole, also the theme of a theme parks. Like, you see these grand aesthetic visions in film and theme park, but there isn't these creative visions in reality. And
yes,
I think another interesting angle to the Griffith Park Observatory is that era in LA and LA in particular in California, it was when Anglos were culturally and demographically dominant, so they became very fascinated with the concept of the exotic. So all this architecture was going up in the 20s that was paying homage to ancient civilizations. So you see that with Art Deco and interest in things relating to ancient Rome, Aztec, Mayan, Middle Eastern civilizations. Also with a kind of a Roman theme, there was a lot of archaeological discoveries back then. But I also think because kind of the contrast between the kind of Anglo demographic hegemony, there was also this fascination, the contrast of the exotic. And I noticed in LA today, like because the demographics have changed so much. I guess when it comes to architecture, we go for the
people. Yeah, it's all steel and glass and kind of very postmodern. Doesn't really reflect ornateness of any kind.
And that's also because kind of diversity and a breakdown in social cohesion. There's going to be less of a strong, cohesive, a utopian vision. So when Anglos were demographically dominant in LA, they could get together and just kind of dream up these grand utopian visions. But in a place like, we went to the more newer Century City Mall. I mean, it's impressive in its own right, but it's a place that's extremely multicultural as far as the people who go there, but it's just the more kind of generic corporate profit-driven architecture. I mean, it is impressive.
Yeah, I like a lot of it, but I mean, it's function-oriented. Totally.
Yeah, exactly. So
it's like we won't bother ourselves with any kind of cultural symbolism or identity because none of us have the same one. So we're gonna go for functionality's sake, and that's gonna be the aesthetic of our culture.
Yeah, and that kind of ties in with the theme is that conservatives bash multiculturalism sometimes for emphasizing the difference. But I actually think the end result of that is just this lack of cohesion, which leads just to this kind of a uniform, this kind of bland uniform culture. So I think what we need to kind of what we need to strive for is to create something that is positive and utopian. And I also think there's a lot we can learn from different political scenes.
I mean, yeah, I think a lot of what Dyer's work points to are some of the machinations of groups, you know, the powers that be, but also to a lot of the aesthetics. And I think that we could really kind of look to a lot of kind of esoteric symbolism and esoteric aesthetics, like that of the Masons, and that stuff you'd find in Crowley. And as I've said a few times now during this show, I do think those kinds of aesthetics relate to a certain kind of perennial truth about power dynamics that we could kind of tap into if we were thinking about, you know, creating a new sort of vapor aesthetic to guide us in the postmodern era.
Matthew Pegas, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.